Hello and welcome to All My Friends Are Drummers. My name is Kevin Gaudette. Thanks for being here and taking a little bit of time to listen. Today's episode features a conversation with Ryan Hook. I know Ryan from practicing with him at a yoga studio when we both lived in Edmonton, Alberta. Ryan has since relocated to Victoria on Vancouver Island, which is a perfect place for his silky smooth, reggae-infused jams to be born and to make homes in the laid-back ears of island dwellers. In our conversation, we discuss songwriting from a drummer's perspective, crafting successful DIY recordings and releases, crucial differences between collaborating and band leading, pivotal musical experiences and awakenings, the intricacies of playing live versus in the studio, different ways of approaching practice, understanding and executing reggae and related styles, and much more. Thanks again for being here. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Let's get to it. This is my chat with Ryan Hook. So yeah, like I mentioned, knowing you from the yoga studio is really great. And just knowing that you have this drumming thing deeply woven into your life makes you kind of the perfect guy. Yeah, just for background, I mean, that's kind of how I know you is through the yoga studio. And I think we tried to play a show together at one point in time. I know I gave you Mercy Funk's contact info, but that never did end up panning out. Either for COVID reasons
pandemic,
or...
actually.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the casualties, one of the billions of live show casualties that I'm sure there were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So that's maybe an interesting place to start, given that there's no shows to be played and stuff like that. Right now, you said you're focusing on making an EP. And obviously, you're having to maybe expand beyond just drumming to do that. Is that correct?
Oh yeah. Yeah. With the EP, it's mostly like my songs that I've written. And I guess to like put this under the umbrella of drumming as well, I always found it interesting how a drummer's brain, like once you are a drummer, you are that in every aspect of your life. So like,
yes,
you know, even in yoga, like when if I was doing yoga, I would have some type of drumming pattern or a pattern within my, a rhythm that was just like guiding me through the practice.
And, nice. Just like something that's on repeat. That's like rhythmic and like a drone or a mantra almost kind of, right?
Truly, truly. And it's kind of nice because drumming is this other language that you can kind of converse in, that you don't have to be like caught up in a purveying thought, or it can just be like a simple four-four beat that you're just like, oh, there's something here. And it's kind of nice to get lost in that and to bring that back to the album. Yeah, it's wild how much my experience with drumming like really influences how a song's groove is, how the lyrics interact with the beat, how everything kind of, I always relate it back to drums for some reason.
Yeah. Do you then start like in this songwriting process? I don't know how much songwriting you've done before this, but like, are you kind of starting with a drum groove in your head, which I think is kind of backwards for most people. Most people would start with like a guitar riff or some chords or whatever. But I think that's how I would do it. I haven't done much songwriting, but like, whenever I'm playing drums, for example, it's like there's always music going on in my head if I'm just improvising or whatever. So I think that's how I would go about songwriting is actually kind of starting with drums. So has that been the way it's been for you too this time around?
Yeah, I would say, I don't know. Honestly, songs just fall out of my mouth sometimes. So it's kind of lucky, but there definitely is always like some type of syncopation there. And that's how I kind of get inspired, because, you know, you can play a bunch of chords one day and, you know, not really see anything in them. And then another day you might play them in such a way because of the syncopation that it inspires, like something that you're desperate to be talking about. And then for me, the lyrics just always come out, not on purpose, but always end up being pretty beautiful in the end.
Awesome.
But yeah, yeah. I've definitely, when I was in like playing drums and bands more, I was definitely like, hey, I came up with this cool beat that I think we could make a song off. Like, let's layer on top of that. So when I was playing drums more, yeah, I would build songs like that for sure.
Yeah. It's always interesting too. What it makes me think of is like, oftentimes if I'm in that improvisational state playing drums or whatever, and I can hear that music in my head, and I'm like, and I'm even like recording myself, just like taking voice memo video recordings or whatever, you know, something really quick and easy and dirty to record myself. But do you have the experience ever of like it being difficult to get back to the headspace you were in when you were creating that drum beat or whatever, and you were hearing that music in your head, and at that moment in time you're like, this is so cool, like I see the direction that this could go, and then if you listen to it the next day or whatever, that context is like gone. It's just like gone somewhere else, and you have the recording, so you're literally listening to the same thing, but you cannot, like, you can't connect to it in the same way. Like the magic has like moved somewhere.
That's pretty odd. Yeah, that, and I'm sure like you probably feel the same. That happens so much. Like you can spend 8 hours on whether it's a song or a short story or anything, and you can be like, wow, this is my best work yet. And then the next day comes and you're like, this is some of my worst and I want to throw it in the garbage. Like,
yeah,
it happens. Yeah. I don't know what that is. Like,
yeah, to me, it's always seemed like it's a loss of context, like where you were when you were in that creative zone, where it made sense has moved on. So it's no longer like poignant, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, to me, at least, I always said, like, if you write a song or you spent an entire day doing something and the next day it feels like crap and you feel like you're wasting your time, you didn't waste your time.
Absolutely.
Because at least you tried, and, you know, that's all we can really hope for.
Well, and I think that, you know, there's kind of a cycle the way I see it in terms of having to put in a little bit of work or effort, even if it's 8 hours of like spinning your wheels, like you're describing. But if you do that work, you know, you go to bed and you wake up the next morning or something like that, and having done that work is what actually creates the inspiration, if you know what I mean. So it's like, if you kind of like get your hands dirty and get in there for a while, and even better if you can have something to show for it. So even if it's just, like I said, as simple as like recording on a voice memo or taking a quick video of an idea or something, if you have something, oftentimes that's enough of a seed for that to actually like turn into inspiration as well.
Yeah.
Like the inspiration has to be earned is kind of how I see it. Right. It's not, it's not like you're just inspiration suddenly just rains down from above and you have this great idea all of a sudden. You have to earn that in the first place. You have to be like putting the pieces into motion. And then when there's enough momentum there, it sparks into something.
Yeah. True that. And I think, there's, especially in like art culture, there's such a fascination with like boy or girl wonders at like 12 years old, like, you know, being able to play with Yo-Yo Ma or something like that. And then it gives the people who, you know, maybe it doesn't come as natural, but it's still natural to them. And, but it just takes work. Yeah. That's what that always gets me down sometimes. Cause I'm like 27 now and I'm just like, I'm only putting up my first EP now. It's like Jim Morrison had 3 albums out, but
yeah,
it's, comparison is the thief of joy, right?
That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going on 35 here next month. And it honestly took me all of my 34 years to just even like have the confidence to call myself an artist. And that was actually like a huge thing. Because like you say, in our culture, in our society, it's kind of tacitly encouraged that that's something you do as a hobby or you do on the side, or it's not the main thing. It's like, yeah, you do your art and you fart around with your art when you have some spare time or whatever. That's nice. But it's so empowering to just like actually have enough confidence and belief in what I could potentially produce to be like, no, I think first and foremost, art is the important thing for me. That's actually the main driving force. And yeah, that took 34 years to even get to that point. So
yeah,
it's like things are just beginning.
Truly. You know?
So yeah, I think you're doing great, man. 27 years old and trying to put an EP together is, man, yeah, it's going to go good places.
A lot of work and a lot of money.
Well, how are you
more
doing?
More money than you think.
Yeah, like you're doing it all yourself, or have you done studio time or anything like that?
Yeah, so in September, we got this grant from this guy in Benalto, which is like near Sylvan Lake. It's probably the tiniest town. It's not even considered a town. It's so tiny. It takes 10 minutes to walk around. But there's just one cool music studio there that it's just like, well, there's nothing else to do here. So just like put in the time. So we got this grant to live there for a week. Okay. So I lived there and I got all of my musicians to come in and like lay some stuff down, got that down. And then starting in January, I worked with this mixing engineer named Brett Reed. And we've just been kind of picking apart songs, like figuring out what works, what not. Mm-hmm. And yeah, now I started like with a PR firm because one PR firm like picked up on one of my songs from a friend and they were just like, we can get your music in Hawaii. And I'm like, oh, that's that's nice. Like, I never thought about that, but I think because right now I don't want to put something out and then like it go like a fart in church, you know, like I don't want people to go, oh yeah. And then just like move on. I do really want people to listen. And I think it's good enough that people should listen.
Right.
Which has also, much like you, taken me a long time to have the confidence to actually be like, people should listen to this.
This is worth it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Has your vision for this EP kind of shifted throughout this whole process? You said it kind of started last year. Mm-hmm. When you got this grant. So is the way you saw the future unfolding when you knew that you were going to get that grant, has it kind of adhered to reality, or have things shifted in any significant ways?
100%. Yeah, I definitely first got it being like, oh, I just need recordings out. And now I'm like being patient and being like, okay, regardless of the money, like that's why I work to do things like this. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not into Bitcoin investment. So like, I wish I was.
Yeah.
There's more money in it.
If we could do it passively, then all the better, but you're still having to go into the office a few days a week, basically.
Yeah. I mean, even with that takes like, people are like, Bitcoin's easy. And I'm like, that actually takes like so much work to understand like what's going on there as well. So it's sure, like either that or my art, and my art kind of precedes that. But when I first recorded, it was just like the times I've recorded in other bands, it's go in the studio for as cheap as possible, try and get the best recording out there. If something's off, whatever, just release it and then play live shows.
Yeah.
But now with no live shows and like this so much space to breathe because I'm not so focused on like playing live shows. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I'm really valuing you know, just taking my time and putting out a piece of work that I will still be listening to like 10 years from now and be proud.
Yeah, totally. How do you as a drummer view the difference between playing in the studio and playing live? Like, how are those different animals for you?
Yeah, I find that I get so overexcited when I play live shows.
Uh-huh. Yeah, in terms of just like speeding up.
Yeah, I think I just get so, it's like I'm in the zone, but I'm also like way too excited because mm-hmm. I get excited really easily. You know, someone could be like, I like this movie, and I'd be like, wah! Like just bouncing off the walls. But yeah, same with like live shows. So I find when I'm in the studio, I have a lot more time to relax, and I eventually get some good takes out of it. I find that when I'm live, and this is like such a mistake, is when I try to experiment with like different fills, right, or like different stuff, because I want to put on an entertaining show.
Yeah.
And then when I'm in the studio, I'm just like supporting the song. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It's not good. The live show should be also treated like support the song.
Yeah. I mean, it's in such good faith though, those urges to experiment. It's like, it's coming from such a good place.
Yeah.
Like I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's actually even bizarre watching your mind in those moments. You know, it's crazy how much time can kind of slow down sometimes when you're playing live. You can literally be having the thought of like, I'm going to try this crazy thing that I know I probably shouldn't, and it's maybe going to go wrong, but I already can't stop myself. And this is all happening in like the blink of an eye, right? Yeah, I don't know if you experience stuff like that, but yeah, sometimes laugh at myself, man.
Yeah, these split second thoughts that you like, even in yoga, when you take the time to look, like observe how many thoughts you actually have at once or mm-hmm. simultaneously, mm-hmm. like those are happening in drumming, and they're all to do with drumming, which is the best part. You know, you're not as focused. I mean, there's obviously like, do I look cool? Like, which is something that I think in any facet of life you're trying to get over. Mm. But, yeah, it's wild how fast it happens when you're drumming at a live show.
Yeah. Now on that topic of kind of experimenting in a live setting, in your opinion, I'm so interested in practice and how to practice effectively. And it's something it kind of coincided, like I mentioned before, with just kind of identifying myself as a drummer and an artist more freely and more confidently. But basically, like, I'm wondering if you think that that learning how to practice in a different way, because like I said, I'm really just starting to understand how to practice for myself effectively these days. I feel like that's really just beginning. So do you think that if you practiced, you know, I think every drummer probably thinks that they could practice more at the end of the day. It's just like, yeah, that would more of that would probably be better.
Yeah.
But if you learned how to practice more and better or more like appropriate for your exact needs, would there be a possibility of those, you know, sudden improvisations in a live setting? Do you think that you'd be able to pull them off more often?
Yeah, 100% for yeah, sure. Yeah.
Like your improvisational ability is a function of how and how much you practice.
Yeah. Because when you think about it, like your, what's the right word? Like the area of where you can be comfortably is here, mm-hmm. and where you want to experiment or how far you can think ahead is usually past your ability, right? Like,
yes. Yeah.
You know, once you become a decent drummer, then you start to look at drummers, like jazz drummers or something, but you're still here, but you're thinking that you're a little bit further up,
mm-hmm.
because you observe and you're a fan and you become kind of pretentious because you're like, I'm a drummer, I know this drummer, but it's like, but you convince yourself that you're like as good as them, and you're like, well, why are they famous and I'm not? But yeah, so often without the practice, you think your threshold of where what you can do is like further than it actually is, but without the practice or the ability to do it, then it's just going to come off sloppy.
Like, yeah.
It's just, especially in a live situation, because you're like feeling like, you know, you feel like a star, but you know, you haven't been there yet. And then it's funny too, because people prefer drummers who stay within that threshold. And if mm-hmm. you do try to go above, then people are going to be like, well, that wasn't a very good drummer. And you're like, well, I was, but
Yeah, you just don't understand what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, it's like performance art, and you're just like, well, is that good?
Yeah. Well, but on the other hand,
I've seen your practicing videos, and they're awesome. They're,
oh, thanks.
Yeah. I've been learning a lot from those, actually.
Awesome. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm referring to, is like, I'm actually taking the time to work on things that I know are going to be like really, really good for me. Like, I'm not working out of any books or online videos or anything like that. I'm just kind of like sitting down and being like, what feels like extremely difficult and what feels like an underdeveloped part of my body or my playing or whatever. And let's like invent some little methods to strengthen those, basically.
Yeah. There's this English artist, Jacob Collier. He's a young kid. He's like 23. He's won Grammys and he's an amazing, he plays everything. And someone asked him in a Q&A, how do you get better with practice? Like, how do you know what to practice? And he's such an organic musician. And he was just like, honestly, I know what to practice when it reveals itself to me. Like,
oh, that's awesome.
Everything that he doesn't really go by books, but when he's at a certain point, when he's at a threshold, then he's like, oh, I wonder how I could do this, because he starts thinking creatively on the instrument. And he's like, you know, I wonder how I could play double kick while my left hand is hitting, you know, quarter notes on the hi-hat and my right hand is hitting, you know, the timbale or something like that. And it just happens naturally. And I think that's kind of been my approach as well. And when it comes to like rudiments and whatnot, I usually listen to DJ music because I know that it actually has a metronome like built in, because it's naturally like that.
Yeah.
And then, so that way I can have fun with it. And then I can start, you know, becoming experimental with like, you know, where to put my accents and what rudiments to do as well.
Totally, man. Yeah, that's a part of practicing that I've been doing lately that I haven't really been broadcasting or sharing very much. But as you know, I'm playing drums outside right now, and we had this like big cold snap recently.
At minus 40.
Yeah, so like it's actually pretty amazing. Like, I can get out there until it's like minus 23, 24. But if there's a wind chill and everything, then it's just no.
Your poor drums.
Well, how are they holding up? I kind of have a beater kit out there for that reason. Yeah. But yeah, I'm doing, you know, when it's cold like that, I can still practice inside. I just put like a towel out on the countertop, and I put music on and, you know, just kind of invent like rudiment exercises. So incredibly helpful. Like it's the less glorious, less sexy, less celebrated part of it all. Right. Like, but every time I do it, and I kind of cross over a threshold into like, wow, my body is like learning something and understanding and expanding in some way. It's chops, basically. Like, every time I do that, it has such like clear benefit when I go out onto the drum kit the next time. It is at the end of the day, it's hard to argue that the importance of developing chops and just having like even a, I can't help but saying it, a rudimentary knowledge of rudiments is like a really awesome thing.
Yeah, truly. It's funny too. Like, I know that when I was younger and I was practicing, I was like, what is this doing?
Yeah.
And there was a long time when I first started playing drums. So I started playing drums when I was 12. I got it for Christmas. And thank you, my parents, because like, no parent wants to get their kid a drum kit. God bless them. I was playing piano up until I played piano at like with the Royal Conservatory up until grade 7. So technically I can teach like classical piano. And then I hated that, obviously, because I was playing classical.
And the drums were out there on the horizon. Like,
I was listening to Led Zeppelin and I was like, well, they don't play piano. Lord, did I know that they were playing organ or...
And then John Paul Jones comes and smacks you in the face.
So I get drums when I'm 12, and it probably took 4 or 5 years before anything clicked where I realized that I could be creative. And I remember specifically playing the drums, and my dad was watching like CNN or some shit. And I was just like playing, kind of practicing. And then something happened where all of the knowledge of the like 4 or 5 years of practice, I was like, wait, I don't have to just play what's on the paper. I can use everything that I've ever learned and like start to do things. And then I remember that moment really clearly. And that was like,
thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Yeah. That was my musical awakening where I was like, cause it was, you know, Royal Conservatory, where it was like, learn the pages, learn to memorize it, learn the scales. It was very antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
And then when drums came into my life, that was the musical awakening in that specific moment. It was great.
Awesome. I'm reading Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, right now. It's all about the history of psychedelics. So what you described just reminds me of like, you'd been like in the staunch conservative 50s, and then you basically had your LSD experience in that moment, and the 60s began for you.
Yeah, basically.
No, but in all serious, man, like that's like, it actually gave me shivers when you were describing that, because I know those, like those watershed moments, and they don't come often, and it's such a powerful thing. And you know, you were lucky in the sense too that you started when your brain was basically like still growing and developing, right? Like 13, mm-hmm. 12, 13, that's a great time to start playing drums or any instrument. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, this is all just speculation, but it sounds to me like in that moment there was like a real crystallization of something in, like the drums are a part of you now, and they're going to be a part of you forever.
Truly. And like, even in saying that, and I have no sources to back this up, but and maybe you can help me, I've heard that the drums is like left right brain hemispheres, basically that's where you interact, because it's that antiquated sort of mathematical, and then that creative side. I don't know if you can comment on that.
Maybe in a few months.
after these conversations.
Yeah. Well, also, like, it's funny you mentioned that. Like, I talked to Sebastian a little bit about this, but I love anything like neuroscience related, and especially if it relates to something like yoga or music. Yeah, when we were chatting, just a couple of podcasts and another book I'm reading came up that are all about like the hemispheres of the brain, mm-hmm. and the laterality of the brain is kind of the neuroscience term, I guess. But I think that, like, if a drummer can gain some basic level of understanding of that reality in themselves, like it's going to be helpful, I think.
Some
degree of neuroscience knowledge, is going to be a good thing for drummers to have. I wanted to loop back to one thing that you mentioned too about practicing and learning. You know, we're talking a little bit about rudiments there, and I can't remember the guy's name that you mentioned, the young guy that's won all the Grammys.
Jacob Collier.
Okay. So yeah. I loved how you described his practice approach as being so like organic basically. Yeah. And it's coming to him as revelation basically, which is, I love that approach too. And when it comes to rudiments, you know, I think where a lot of people get tripped up with the rudiments is that they seem so bland, lifeless, and useless. Like, how could you ever apply this into a real playing setting? But where I ended up getting my appreciation for rudiments and how they can strengthen playing is through having that kind of organic experience of them. So it's like, I wasn't doing anything unless it felt good and it was fun. And then one day, things that felt good and were fun were rudiments. So it's like, I made the discovery of the rudiment, right? It wasn't somebody else saying, you need to do this, you need to do this, and you don't really understand why. It's like, you come to it on your own terms, basically, right?
Truly. And most artists don't like authority. So when someone says, you need to learn this, you're just like, screw you. I'm doing this because I hate authority.
Exactly. That's not at all the reason why I play music or drums or whatever. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the rudiments are fun. Even if it was like I had lessons from Bill George. Do you know that drummer?
The name sounds familiar. Yeah,
super super good drummer and like Edmonton drumming legend. If you ever need a drummer, he's a good guy. He filled in when Chani Tuna from Jurassic 5 played in Edmonton in like 2012 or 13. That day, like their drummer couldn't make it on the plane or something. And that day, and he loved Jurassic 5 whenever I had lessons. Yeah. That day, they got him and he played a set that night. And I remember being in the crowd and being like, that's my drummer. And then everyone be like, that drummer is amazing. And I was like, what a guy to learn from. But even him being like, you need to learn this. I was like, screw you.
Yeah. I love you and respect you and you're the best guy on the planet, but I'm still not gonna do what you tell me to do.
Yeah. And he was a huge proponent. And I think I saw that you had the book, Being Ambidextric.
Right. Yeah. Like the new breed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He loved that. And he was all about that. And he had like the left jazz grip, which I'm always jealous of drummers who do that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
One day. But yeah, the ambidextric thing, that's something that I think rudiments can really help with as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, because there's no escaping using, say, your left hand just as much as your right hand. So it has to pull its socks up, so to speak. And
those ghost notes, when you get those ghost notes in there, oh.
Oh, yeah, 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 that's... That makes it worth it just in itself. Yeah, if
you that's where the money is.
A little bit, yeah. Oh, it feels so good. So good. Oh.
The one I always, my philosophy and kind of the philosophy that I look for when I'm looking for people in my band too, is like, if they value not playing as much as playing, in terms of like, in a song,
leaving space.
Yeah,
cool.
I think that's a huge thing for me.
Nice. So back to that then, maybe you're basically a band leader at this point in time.
Yes, cool. Sure. Reluctantly, but I'm getting into the role now.
Well, at a certain point, I guess you kind of like if your personal vision gets strong enough, you start to realize that the only way to create that is if you're at the helm of the ship, right? And
that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to get the right people on board that boat to make it happen, or do it all yourself, I guess.
Yeah. And with this band, Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights, like I had recorded a few demos where it was going to be like more of a band, like everyone has equal input kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the demos just didn't speak to me. And they're two of the songs that are going to be released on the EP, but have been recorded entirely differently. But when they were with the band, I like almost saw them like slipping away. And I was just like, oh, I guess this is a band. So like, sure, I'll let it happen. But in the back of my mind, like listening to the songs and hearing like the people be like, I need a guitar solo there. And me being like, oh, I don't know, but I'm in a band. So yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. It feels much better knowing that this project is mine and the sounds in my head I can get across.
So was did that create any like strain or strife with the people that you're playing with when you had to kind of reorganize the power structure in the band?
Yeah, everyone quit. So
so you literally made a new band.
I've had about three or four different variations of this band. Okay. At one point I was drumming and singing. Another point I was playing bass and singing. I just wanted to sing and not play guitar, but then my guitar chops got better. So now I'm playing rhythm guitar and singing. And nice. Yeah, cool. That's where I'm comfy for sure.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. And maybe to loop back to the beginning, how does drumming inform like guitar playing and lead vocal work for you?
Yeah. I love having the drumming background when I'm playing guitar, because I can be percussive on the guitar, especially with like more reggae music where upstrokes and like a more percussive tone can come out of the guitar really easily. Like if maybe if you're playing like more folky music with like kind of ringing guitar.
Yeah, more you're filling textures. That in.
Yeah. But with reggae, it's particularly, it's nice to be sharp. It's really cool to be staccato. And yeah, it was a natural thing that I was going to be into more reggae influenced stuff because of that percussive element.
Yeah. Yeah. You're playing drums on the guitar to some extent.
It's amazing. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
The drummer that you have now, how did you, since you're a drummer, how did you find a drummer that you like trust basically to do what you
I want? Don't trust my drummer. I will say that out loud and I've said that to him.
So how does that work?
I'm a guy who loves, I like right-hand men in my band or women, whatever they are.
Yeah.
Right now, I would say my lead guitarist is like my right hand. So like when a mix comes out, I call him and I get his opinion and I bounce the ideas off him.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I had Mikhail, who you know, he was kind of my right-hand dude.
Right.
But yeah, my drummer's just, he works like shift work. So it's, you know, it's the classic plight of a working class artist is having to also work.
Yeah. Yeah. So making rehearsals work and having the resources to put towards the band is always in tension with other things.
And yeah. And to like answer your question clearly, like with drummers, I find sometimes they really impress me with like what they have brought to the table. Cause I'm like, oh, I would have never thought that. And other times I'm like, I just wish I was drumming and like I just wish there was me and I could be like I want my drum sound.
Yeah.
So it's nice when you're recording that like I can actually get the groove and drum sound I want a little more easily.
Yeah, and then you basically come to your drummer and say this is what I want, like basically recreate this.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was working with a guy called Jamie Cooper as well, who's a really great drummer out of Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And he laid a drum track down for one of the lead singles too.
Cool.
He was a dream to work with.
Nice. Just thinking of it too, the two names that you mentioned, Jamie Cooper and what was the guy's name that played with?
Bill George.
With Jurassic 5 and Bill George. Just kind of good to get a little bit of a database of drummers around.
There's the Edmonton Drummers Facebook group. I don't know if you're in that.
I don't think so. No.
Oh, I'll invite you to it. Okay, yeah, cool. People just talk shit about drumming all day.
Nice. Perfect. Yeah, I could maybe just put it out there that
everybody
wants to, instead of type about drums, chat about drums, then maybe it's a place to do it.
Especially Bill George. He is like an aficionado. Like drumming is his life, and you know he'll pull out abstract and random names like JoJo Mayer and be able to be like, yeah, so when I was like playing the JoJo Mayer beat, and you're like, what?
Cosmopolitan drummer that somehow landed in Edmonton, Alberta.
true that.
With your band Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights, you've been saying that it's very reggae informed, and that's kind of always been an area of interest for you, sonically speaking, aesthetically speaking. Is that what you've spent a lot of time developing on the drum set, is kind of that reggae sensibility of things?
Yeah.
I ask because it's so different. Like whenever I try and play reggae, it's like trying to speak Swahili or something.
Truly
it's just so different and unintuitive to the things that are like programmed into my body and mind. So like I'm just kind of wondering about you coming from like a Western music tradition where, you know, there's reggae influence, you know, you just listen to any like R&B radio or something like that, like it's out there, but it's not the most intuitive thing rhythmically speaking. You know, most people that get interested in drums in the way that you described when you're 13 years old or whatever, you know, you start playing rock and roll for the most part. So
100, yeah.
when did reggae come along, and how were you able to kind of integrate the strange way of holding the groove that reggae is about?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because a lot of people, when I say I play reggae, are like immediately turned off just because of like where cultural appropriation is at and all that. But like personally, I spent 3 years in a row. My parents took me to Jamaica for 2 weeks, 3 years in a row.
So you're immersed.
Yeah. So this was like when I was 13, 14, 15. So like I said, remember I was having those musical awakenings. So it coincided perfectly that I was in Jamaica and there was so much reggae going on. And my dad loves the music. And yeah, I just started to just talk to all, like I was, my dad, the like local band that was playing, I was just infatuated, and my dad took me to them and was just like, my son loves your music. And the guy was just like, oh, and he like spent the night with me, just like teaching me how the reggae beat, like the ands coming in on the ands rather than the ones, was essentially like an FU to the British colonists. Because
Crazy.
and so this is what he's explaining to me. I can't like cite the source on this, but this is what he said.
Yeah.
And coming on the ands was like an FU to the colonists, because all of their music was 1, 2, 3, 4. Mm-hmm. And reggae particularly is actually, some people might think reggae is the oldest form, but ska is actually the first
form.
And then reggae was actually developed and coined by Toots, I think Toots and the Maytals in 1967.
Okay. So, and then there was like dance hall and
But reggae was actually the last form of that. Even dance hall was before that,
right?
Because dance hall and ska was huge in the clubs in Jamaica.
Yeah.
And then when Britain was taking a lot of Jamaican immigrants, a lot of the Jamaican immigrants who went to Britain brought a lot of ska and reggae. That's why you saw that second wave with like the Specials and all that. So like, yeah, I became really immersed in that in those 3 years. And then when I started writing songs at like 18, they just happened to be reggae vibes, because that's what I was into. Yeah.
I mind blown with that interpretation of how the reggae groove kind of came to be.
Very cool.
And I think it is kind of something that's shrouded in a little bit of myth and mystery. There's a songwriter in town, Anne Vriend. Do you know her?
Yeah.
So she was helping Mercy Funk out with a few things a few months back, just kind of like songwriting consultancy, basically. And she's great, and she knows so much about music and kind of like the science of crafting like really compelling pop songs. Like she knows how to create hooks and all this stuff. It's really, really great. But we got talking about reggae as well, and the one thing she had heard as a theory as to how the upbeats came to be emphasized and also having the kick on 2 and 4 is that it was actually music, like American music coming from like islands close by to Jamaica. I don't know, like Cuba would make sense because Cuba is so close to Miami. But anyway, I don't know the details of the story, but basically music was traveling across the ocean, but because of the delays in sound and like higher frequencies reached quicker than, so like the kick arrived later than the snare, basically. So the way they heard that music was like, oh, I guess like the kick's supposed to be on 2 and 4 or whatever. And they just started doing that. Yeah. And I was like, that would be so crazy if that was the case.
That's so wild to me. Yeah. It's just like even miscommunication is communication, right? Like
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, it's like a genetic mutation that turns out to be really, really fruitful.
Very cool. Yeah. I like that a lot.
And then the other thing I wanted to mention about Jamaica, I don't know where you spent your time in Jamaica. I went there once, and I went to a place, I believe it was called the Blue Star Resort or something like that, kind of near, we were in the Negril area.
Yeah, that's where I was.
Okay. But we took a bit of a drive. We met this local guy, and he took us for a bit of a drive to go see some music one night. And we ended up at another like tourist like club restaurant type thing. So we weren't like deep into the local scene or anything like that. But the band, I think I had just mentioned like that I was a drummer and I was interested in live music and stuff. So he took us to see this band, and well, what it wasn't a band, it was more of a troupe. They're all djembe players.
Oh, djembe players, sick.
And I don't even know the names of all the drums. There's one drum that's kind of played on its, it's like a cylinder up on its side, and then
Oh yeah. I don't know the name of that either.
And he also had like some cowbell type things that he was playing. He was doing the craziest polyrhythms, like just between the two of his hands was nuts, man.
Like, yeah.
And the djembe playing was, it was one of the standout musical performances I've ever seen in my life. And part of it was, you know, just being far away from home and getting into this like tiny beat up car with this guy that we just met and driving through.
Classic.
Yeah, these crazy streets to get to where we were going, and then smoking some good Jamaican weed and just watching these guys like go off. Yeah. I remember they were tuning up their djembes kind of back behind where we were sitting, and the band leader, from what I could see, he was just huge, like hands the size of like two or three of my hands, I'm sure.
Oh my god.
And
yeah,
he smacked, his djembe was massive, and he just smacked that thing to get a sound out of it. I was scared. I thought like a gun had been fired or something like that. It was so crazy. And I was like, okay, this is gonna be a pretty cool performance, I think. And then I was just spellbound the whole time. Like, there is good music happening in Jamaica, that's for sure.
Oh yeah, man. It's a mecca for that good stuff too. Yeah. And even the patois language is so interesting, and like, so it's also a very percussive, and if you ever hear patois rappers, like, oh my
right.
god,
yeah,
it's, you might not understand what they're saying, but you get a vibe of what they're saying, and it's,
yeah, so much,
I think that's like, enough sometimes,
sass and attitude and just like,
yeah,
power from the like the delivery of the words themselves, I guess.
Yeah, it's a very cool language.
Yeah, nice. Do you do any hand drumming?
Yeah, I was going to say, I actually have spent a good amount of time with the djembe.
Okay.
When I was in high school, I remember I got a djembe and had at that point taken a little bit of time away from like the standard kit to kind of discover what the djembe offers. And yeah, that was a very cool instrument to have. And then when I went and traveled when I was 17 to like Eastern Europe and Western Europe, it like unbeknownst to me, went to 99% like rally or whatever. I didn't know it at the time. And I had asked someone, I was like, what is this rally? And they were like, I don't know, but it's fun. And I was like, okay. And there was a drum circle there, and there was an open djembe. Ooh, and I was like, oh my God, I had just spent 3 years. And it was one of the cool, I hadn't really been involved in a drum circle particularly. So went and grabbed the djembe, was in this drum circle. And that was another awakening for sure. Cause I was like, holy crap, like a troupe of drummers can make a song.
Nice. Yeah. And also just like being that far away from home again and connecting with people in a pretty deep, intimate way, without speaking a word and without knowing them at all on any kind of personal level.
Yeah. And apparently protesting the 1%, which I didn't know. And I don't know if the people in the drum circle knew either. Who knows?
I'm sure you still made a difference.
Right? Yeah.
What do you think you've gained from that study of hand drumming and how it kind of applies to what you do on the drum set, and did you ever get any like formal training on how to play the djembe? I don't think very many people do.
No, yeah, I just kind of looked up YouTube, and I think it's informed like different auxiliary percussion when I'm recording, especially right now. And when I'm getting mixes back, I'm like, oh, it'd be great if there's some auxiliary percussion in that point. So I've been, you know, working with tambourines and egg shakers and bongos and all that good stuff. So I think the djembe, my study of that kind of opened me up to auxiliary percussion, because at that point I wasn't really aware of it. I just thought drums is a kit. Like,
yeah,
that's it. But you realize there, you know, you can use a kitchen table to record on a song, and there's tricks that you can use that percussion is much more than just a kit. It's feelings.
Yeah, definitely. And I just kind of recently had this thought practicing the other day too. And it's an idea I've heard a long time ago. I've heard it multiple places too, but looking at the drum set as a conglomeration of individual parts, right? Mm. So I was just noticing when I was practicing that, like, the hi-hat is actually really, really difficult to play just because of the way in my experience, kind of like the bounce and the angle that the positioning of it, being off to the side and a little bit higher. Like, I was like, this is actually really difficult for me to play like this. Like, it's not just that I can do one thing on the hi-hat and then I could, or the snare drum, and then I could perfectly recreate that on the hi-hat. It's like a totally different animal. It's a different instrument. And, you know, not to beat it to death and totally dissect and deconstruct things and get that deep, but it's good to have a bit of an appreciation of all of the individual parts that make up a drum set, and even some of the history too, like going back and looking at pictures of drum sets from like the 1920s or whatever, and you know, all the like low boy hi-hats and stuff like that, all the weird stuff people were doing, and just the whole evolution to like these crazy like technological feats that are drum sets today in many cases.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. I kind of awakening to that, like, now I've never looked at a drum kit and been like, okay, why is this the way it is?
Yeah. there's very good reasons. Yeah, and you know, you could probably point to evolutionary pressures, basically. You could kind of transplant that idea onto the pressures being what works for people, like ergonomically, the pressures being like what sounds need to be created for the music that's being popularized.
Yeah.
The pressures being what's available and known in terms of, you know, because like snare drums were around for hundreds of years probably before that. So it's like those were available. So of course a snare drum is going to be incorporated into a drum kit and occupy a central role. So yeah, interesting to kind of reverse time and see where it all came from. I don't spend lots of time there, but
I know personally, like, I just like simple drum kits. Like, you know, you come from a metal background where it's like, let's have a hi-hat on my nose. Like,
but I, in that world, I was always as the most simple out of anybody for sure.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I'm with you actually on the simple kits actually. Like, the beater kit that I was talking about happens to be a 5-piece kit. So I was like, well, what the hell? I'll just play a 5-piece kit for a while, because I haven't for a long time.
Right.
And having the two rack toms up top there and everything. And, you know, I used that in that configuration, I guess, for about 6 or 7 months. Cause just yesterday I took the one tom down. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And moving back, like, the 4-piece kit, man, that's where I feel at home. Two cymbals and a 4-piece kit. That's all I need. Two cymbals, a hi-hat, and a 4-piece kit. Like, as soon as I made that shift and took that tom off, it's like, this works for me. My body knows.
Save space.
Yeah. Just where the comfort is. Nice, man. Well, that's probably a pretty good place to leave it.
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe just as one kind of final thing. I mean, part of what I want to be doing here is, you know, with pandemic happening and everything like that, and live music and maybe music in general taking a bit of a hit, just maybe if you could touch on any local music that's really been getting you fired up lately, or even just where people can find like your music once it's ready to come out. And
I will promote my friend, just Emmett Michael, put out a song. It's called God-Shaped Hole, and I think he has a really unique perspective because he is a member of the LGBTQ community and is a trans man who is also a devout Christian, and he kind of made this song, God-Shaped Hole, about his experience being in that, and I thought that was a really fresh and unique take, and for anyone who finds them who is faith-based and also in the LGBTQ community, there's obviously a lot of conflict there. So if you check out his song, God-Shaped Hole, that's a really good one. And then my music, Baby Boy and the Earthly Delights, will be releasing our song in early March, the lead single, Day by Day. Yeah.
Cool. So we can get some reggae vibes that
a
direct taproot to the source of reggae, as we established.
A nice lyric video too.
Oh, cool. You're doing that yourself too, all the video.
Oh, editing? Not the lyric video, no.
Okay. Yeah.
I wish. I'm taking all the photos, but
okay. Yeah. So much the theme these days though is just like the more you can DIY, the better.
Oh, 100%. Agree. Cool. Thanks for having me too.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, have a very beautiful day. It's good to see your face, man. And
thanks, Kev.
So we'll be in touch, man.
Okay. We'll talk soon. See you, Kev.
Thanks, Ryan. Bye-bye.